July 1937, the world's most famous woman pilot disappears during her attempt to circumnavigate the globe. In 1988, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, a small nonprofit known by its acronym TIGER, began a science-based investigation of the Earhart disappearance. Decades of forensic research and a dozen South Pacific expeditions have now produced hard evidence from multiple disciplines to provide the long-sought answer to the riddle. In this series of conversations with Joan Sachs, TIGER Executive Director Rick Gillespie takes us step by step through the adventures, the setbacks, and the discoveries that uncover the evidence that has solved aviation history's greatest mystery.
Hi, I'm Joan Sachs. Like many of you, I've read newspaper and magazine articles, and I've watched television documentaries about TIGER's adventures and discoveries. As a member of TIGER, I've participated in research, and I know there is so much more to the story that has never been told. I've known Rick Gillespie and his wife, TIGER co-founder Pat Thrasher, for many years. So when Rick asked me to help him bring the behind-the-scenes story of TIGER's Earhart expeditions to the public in a series of podcast episodes, I enthusiastically agreed. Over the years, there have been 12 TIGER expeditions to the South Pacific, and we've organized the podcast into seasons. To follow the progress of the investigation, you'll want to listen to the episodes and seasons in order. For newcomers, we make it easy to catch up with the story so far by publishing a compilation at the end of each season. Now let's get to the next episode. Hey, Rick. When we ended the last episode, you were just about to embark on the 2007 expedition with big plans and a lot of new technology. That must have felt really exciting.
Yeah, but you know, it was more than that. We felt like we had finally hit our stride. This was our eighth expedition in Nicomoraro. For the first several trips, we were basically floundering around. We were increasingly convinced we had the right place, and we had the hypothesis nailed down early on. I mean, yeah. Earhart and Noonan landed on the reef, sent distress calls for several days until the plane was washed into the ocean before the Navy flyover, leaving them to die as castaways. But we didn't know where they landed or how they died. We kept trying different things. Well, maybe this happened. And the answer kept being, no indication that that didn't work. There was a story that Bowen's thought to be Earhart's had been found on the island. But it was a secondhand tale told to a newspaper reporter by a now-dead Coast Guard veteran, and there were lots of things about the story that we knew couldn't be true, and yet, you know, there seemed to be nuggets of truth in that. It took 10 years to find the documentation that proved that that story was true, and it took 12 years to figure out where the plane had landed and where the bones were later found.
Right.
That all took time. You know, it's now hard to remember that when we started this investigation in 1988, there was no email, no internet, no mobile phones. Research was done by visiting archives and libraries and making 25-cent copies. All of our preparation, communication, fundraising was done by snail mail, fax and landline phones. But our expeditions attracted media coverage, and that prompted people to come forward with new information and forgotten documents. And as information technology improved, communication and research became easier and more efficient. And it must be said, we had some amazing strokes of luck. But you have to be in the game to get lucky.
Yes, you're definitely playing.
Yeah, and the perseverance was the key. You have to keep going. You got to be there to get lucky. So by 2007, we knew where to look for physical evidence. And just as importantly, we had learned, as the old Army maxim says, how to shoot, move, and communicate. We knew how to assemble a team. What ship to use, how to deal with the island's terrain and climate. We knew the next steps we needed to take, and we'd equipped ourselves with the new technologies to deal with the difficulties we knew we'd face.
Can you remind us what those were?
Well, the new things we had going for us. We had always needed aerial photography, low-level aerial photography of the island, and we had developed this system. We didn't develop it. We had learned how to use a system called kite aerial photography, where you attach a camera to a platform that is suspended from the string of the kite, which takes out a lot of the movement.
Right.
And the platform rotates, so you just set this digital camera running to take pictures every 5 seconds. And it you just send it up there, and it's click, 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 and
you come back. So it's taking a bunch of still shots.
Taking a whole bunch of still shots.
Yeah, that's cool.
On a rotating platform, and you end up with hundreds and hundreds of pictures. But they're digital. You put them in a computer and you right. sort through them and you pick the ones you want. And you can construct panoramas and stuff. Mm. So it's a good system.
Yeah.
And we were knew we'd want to use that system to get a good look at the reef surface, where we now have a pretty good idea where the airplane landed. So are there scars on the reef surface from the airplane scraping there? Is there something to be learned from that? We needed good overhead photography of that area. And we knew that the 7 site, where we had pretty well convinced ourselves that this is where the bones had been found, this was the campsite, the castaway campsite. Once we got it cleared, we'd want good aerial photography that we could use to map the finds.
Sure.
That we made.
Yeah.
Kite aerial photography is going to do that for us. So we had that. We knew we were going to have to clear that 7 site. You know, it had been 6 years since we were there.
Oh, gosh.
And on that island, you know, 6 years is... everything would have grown back. Mm-hmm. We knew that. We're going to have to start over with
clearing. Did you know if there had been any major storms in that period of time there?
Well, we did know that there had been some storms that hit the island. We didn't know what effect they had, but we also knew that the 7 site is on a part of the island that doesn't typically get hit by storms.
Oh.
It's down at the southeast end, and the storms always hit the northwest end.
So the vegetation has remained...
yeah.
About the same.
Amazingly pristine.
Wow.
There's no indication even of any overwash, that the any tidal surges that have come up.
Wow.
There's never been any water on that site that would bring in flotsam from the ocean.
Sure.
That would kind of pollute the site. What you find there is what has been dropped there over the decades. So, you know, that's really good. But we knew we'd have to clear that thing. We'd have to get rid of that vegetation.
Mm.
And you've got to do it in such a way where you don't mess up the ground that you're going to be examining for artifacts. You can't
right.
just drag stuff around
right.
where you're going to dislodge. You've got to cut it, pick it up, and carry it to someplace out of the way, which is a real pain.
Really?
But... to cut the vegetation, we had 2 pneumatic lobbers. These are tree pruners, mm-hmm. trimmers, big scissors-like things that were air-powered, and we were powering them with scuba dive tanks.
Right, that was a great idea.
Great, and we tested those and it seemed to work fine. But in addition to that stuff, we had great support from the steel, that's STIHL, steel
right,
equipment company. They loaned us 2 chainsaws, and they gave us 6 hand pruners.
Wow.
And 6 what they called our arboricultural hand saws. They're just hand saws with big teeth, but they're great, great hand saws. And 4 hand loppers, just, you know, you just big handles, you plop, plop, plop.
Did you talk to a local dealer for that?
No, I mean, we went to
huge.
The National Home Office and said, here's what we're doing, and we'd like your support. And they said, okay, you know, we'd like you to feature us in your publicity about this. I said, well, of course.
Well, sure.
You know, we always credit our sponsors. And so they sent us all this stuff. But for the chainsaws, what they did was notify their dealer in Fiji. It was in Nandi,
where
the airport is.
So you didn't have to take them.
No. Taking chainsaws on an airline.
Yeah. I mean, it was...
Yeah, it's a problem.
And threatening.
It would be a problem. So all we had to do was pick them up at the dealer.
And get them to the boat.
And get them to the boat.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. But of course, they're giving us all these cutting tools. And so we had to sign all kinds of waivers and releases of liability.
Yes.
And promise them that anytime we use the chainsaws, we would be completely covered in medieval armor or something.
Yeah.
They provided us
with chaps and
stuff.
Protection. And
which, in fact, way too hot to use on Nicu. We never used them.
You're not supposed
but we
to
had
say
them,
that out
you know,
loud.
And nobody got hurt. It was okay. We had latest model metal detectors from White's Electronics, who had been supporting us with metal detectors for many years.
Oh, that's cool.
And they updated this stuff. They just gave us these things. It's wonderful. We knew we were going to have to record the stuff that we fully expected to find. We knew there had to be more stuff at the 7 site. We knew we were going to find stuff. And we knew we would have to be doing some serious archaeology there. That is, shooting things in very accurately so we can make an accurate map to try to understand what was going on the site. And to do that, we had what was called a Sokia SRX Total Station. It was a surveying instrument mounted on a tripod with an infrared rangefinder, and you had poles with infrared reflectors on them. You could really nail things down to the, well, I think millimeter, actually.
Wow. I know we did talk about that last time. Did they train you on that equipment? Somebody
they tried.
But were you able to? I mean, you fully expected to use it.
I thought I knew how to use it. Okay, I got this. Okay, fine.
This sounds like another story.
Well, we'll get to that. Yeah.
Okay.
And we knew we wanted to do a reef survey to test the post-loss signals hypothesis, and the total station was going to come in handy for that. What we needed to do is establish the height of the reef surface in the area where the airplane apparently landed, and then match that to the tides so that we could calculate the actual water level on the reef moment to moment, so we could match that against when the credible radio distress calls were heard, because she would almost certainly have to be running an engine to charge the battery in order to send those signals. And you don't want to send the signals on the battery alone without the engine running, because you'll run down the battery and you need that battery to start the engine. So first you start the engine, then you send the signals. But you can't run the engine if the prop is going to hit the water. You just can't do that.
He said that.
So we've got to be able to answer the question, when this signal was sent, was the water level at that location low enough for the prop to clear? And the only way to do that is to do a detailed survey of that reef surface. And we knew that was going to be tricky.
And that was the one that was around the corner, right?
Well, yeah, something we were going to have to deal with. The only place we could get the information about the tide at various times a day was to put a tide gauge, a pole, a graduated pole, in the landing channel that had been blasted through the reef. But that was about a kilometer from where the area was where we wanted to survey, where the airplane landed. And you couldn't see that spot from the landing channel. So to do that connection, we'd have to go through a waypoint, like a dog leg.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I remember you talked about that.
Yeah. So we knew we were
Was that something when they were training you to use the station? Was that something that they discussed with you?
But it's just a matter of what you've got to do is shoot from the landing channel to your waypoint and get that information, and then go to your waypoint and set up again and shoot from there to your final location.
But that all, well, we don't know if that worked out yet, because you're going to tell us that story
we'll
too.
We'll talk about how that worked out. Of course, Carr Burns, our forensic osteologist, our bone lady, really wanted to do her taphonomy experiment to find out what crabs do with bones after they skeletonize a carcass and they carry off bones. Where do they go with them?
Right. Because I remember you saying they had them, they were drilled and you tied string to them?
We had a pig carcass that had still a lot of meat left on the bones, and we put surgical screws in each bone with a big, long, brightly colored string on them, so that if a crab goes off with a bone, we should be able to either find it with a metal detector, the screw, or trace the string. And of course, we wanted to film all this or take pictures of it for time lapse, so that we could see what was going on. Because a lot of this activity on the carcass was going to happen at night.
Sure. During
the day, it's too hot.
Yeah.
And the crabs know that, so they come out at night and do their thing. So we'd have to have cameras that could record that. So we were set up with the equipment we needed to do that experiment.
Okay.
And then we wanted to survey the old village where pieces that we thought were probably from the airplane had been found in 1989 and again in 2003. But the old village was now just grown up to coconut jungle. There was no fancy answer to dealing with that. We knew we would just have to go in there and pick up the coconuts and put them on tarps and drag them out of the way. It's just hard work, but it's the only way to do it. Most of our team were veterans of previous trips, and they were a true team. They knew each other. They had worked together. They liked each other. They were familiar with the island.
How many archaeologists did you have on this crew?
Two.
Okay.
We had our senior archaeologist and then a junior archaeologist.
Okay, and then you had Carr.
And Carr was a professional.
And how many people were there all together on this
I think
crew?
We had 15.
Okay.
On that. We needed a doctor.
Oh, right.
Well, we put out the word, and the deal was that if you wanted to be a doctor on this expedition, you would come along, but you'd have to make a $50,000 contribution. Okay. You know, you're
going to
Well,
how did that work out?
A sponsor team member. Well, we actually got several people who were interested, and we talked to them, and they said, I don't think so. But we had one guy, a very well-qualified doctor, taught at a university, very experienced in trauma medicine. But I interviewed him and decided that this is not a guy I want to spend a month on a boat with. And we turned him down. He was ready to pay $50,000. But there's no amount of money that's worth having the wrong people on your boat.
Yes,
I had learned
that. You discovered that very early on.
Yeah. We did find a physician by the name of Robin Acker. He was a diagnostic radiographer. He's a guy who looks at x-rays and tells you what you're looking at. Didn't have a lot of experience in emergency room work or that sort of. Well, he had basic training as an MD.
Yes, lots of education.
And he was a really nice guy, and he was willing to kick in nothing like $50,000, but he made a contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, yeah, good. You know, he's a good guy.
That's so cool.
We put Robin aboard. You know, Tiger's exempt purpose with the IRS is that we are an educational foundation. And we had a Tiger member who was a school teacher who had used the Earhart Project in her gifted, talented fourth and fifth grade classes.
Oh, wow.
And with tremendous success. And one of our members, who was well-to-do, said, you need her on this expedition.
Oh, what a great idea.
And he put up $50,000.
Really?
For Barb.
Wow.
Barb Norris.
What an
experience. To come along. And Barb turned out to be a fantastic team member.
Oh, gosh.
Hard worker.
Wow. And I'm sure enthusiastic if she'd been studying it to the point that she was using it with those kids.
So.
That's great. We
had more women on this trip than we had ever had on an expedition.
Good for you.
And it was a real strength of the expedition.
I believe that.
The women keep the men civilized. And that's always a good thing. But they were also very hard worker and tougher than most of the men.
Hmm.
So, now we had an. this is great. We needed an expert in vegetation and trees because we were dealing with questions about what's a Kanawha tree and what's a wren tree, because these are all stuff. Things that crop up in the historical documentation. So we needed to know what we were looking at on the island.
Huh.
And so I needed somebody who could do that. And I knew somebody. I knew him well. He's my nephew, Joshua.
Oh.
My brother's son.
Oh, interesting.
Who had at that time a master's degree in forestry from Syracuse University.
Wow, but that's a far cry from Ireland. So did
he
bring the right books?
He knew from trees, you know. Yeah. He knew how to study up on this stuff. He had a really good basic understanding of that sort of thing. Plus,
he
stands about 6'2", and very fit and strong as an ox, hard worker.
And he can throw coconuts.
Great guy. You know, he's my nephew. Come on, you know. But that was the problem. I can't put my nephew on the team. That's nepotism. That would really look bad with so many people dying to be on this team. Oh, Rick's going to put his nephew on the team. I couldn't do that. I said, well, okay. How do I get her on this? Well, okay, our one team member from Idaho, Bill Carter.
Oh, uh-huh.
Another great big guy, hard worker, an attorney, but we won't hold that against him. Bill was going to be coming to New York City on business. I knew that. And I said, hey, Bill, I have somebody that works in New York City that... He works for the city of New York and is part of their forestry work. He's my nephew. I'd like you to meet him. Oh, yeah. Sounds good. So I knew Bill and Josh would hit it off. They're the same kind of guys. And sure enough, Bill and Josh hooked up and they went out. Bill was still single at the time and Josh was still single at the time. So that went really well. Josh showed him all the great spots in Manhattan to go to. And after that, Bill calls me. He says, Rick, we got to have Josh on the team. I said, Bill, he's my nephew. That would look terrible for me to put him on the team. I don't care what it looks like. We need Josh on the team.
Well, that's an endorsement.
Okay, I guess, you know. So that's how Josh got on the team. I'm afraid it was a setup. But he worked out just as good as I knew he would.
Oh,
he was
like
fantastic.
Somebody that would be so helpful.
Yep. We didn't have any media deal for this trip. we didn't have Discovery, we didn't have History Channel, we didn't have Nat Geo, anything like that. But that was a conscious decision. We said, look, we get out there and find something really dramatic, and we have our own footage of it that we own, that's going to be worth more than any network will pay us on spec.
Sure, yeah.
So we hired Mark Smith, who had been hired before to come with us on the 2001 trip.
Right.
And it worked out so well, we hired Mark to come along and shoot video for us.
Great.
And that worked out well. And of course, Mark is now on our board of directors, and he and I have been all over the world together and made all kinds of films together, and it was wonderful. But that's where it started.
That was great.
First time we hired Mark as Tiger's videographer. So we had a great team assembled. We had good technology, and we departed Lautoka, Fiji, which is right near the airport in Nandi, so it was convenient, on July 14th, 2007, and headed for Nikku, 5 days, 1,000 miles. And as happens, it was a rough passage, man. It's 24 hours out, we were getting high seas, rolling like mad, everybody's seasick. We're taking waves over the bow. It's hard to find a... I was trying to check in with Pat at home with the satellite phone. And it was hard to find a place to use the satellite phone because you can't do it from inside. The antenna's got to see the sky. But if you're out on the deck where you see the sky,
the
water's coming over the side. And you're going to drown the phone.
Oh, gosh.
And we're only making 8 knots. I mean, it's we're like jogging.
But the captain wasn't worried, was he?
No.
Yeah, this was normal travel.
This wasn't like 1997 where we're all going to die.
Yeah.
No, this was just plain rough water. And he got the sail up, which gave us some stability. Still, you know, you're batting along at a 45-degree list. just moving around is really tricky because you can fall and hurt yourself very easily. But we all survived, and we arrived. Well, we sort of survived. A couple people got banged up a little bit, falling. But, you know,
that's hard to help.
Including me.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you hit?
The wall.
What did you hurt?
Well, you know,
shoulder,
my
head.
Arm and ribs, as I recall. Yeah, she's a slam. You go tap dancing along the deck and pow into the side. It's just what happens. There's an old saying, you know, you have one hand for the boat and one hand for yourself. You always have a hand on something. If you forget, you get reminded. Okay, so we arrived on July 20th at Nikku. And immediately noticed there had been more storm damage to the northwest end. The place had been clobbered again. But that happens there. So we set to work clearing the trail to the lagoon shore. And we moved a skiff into the lagoon so that we'd have a boat to use to move down to the seven site. And we set up our tide gauge in the channel. And Carr went looking for a good place to set up her pig experiment.
Right.
So we're just getting set up. Second day out, I'm up on the out on the reef flat. No, it wasn't even the reef flat. It was on the beach coral that's alongside the reef flat. But it's very rough, jagged coral, and it's easier to walk on than the coral rubble on shore. But I was wearing new hiking boots that weren't broken in as well as it should have been.
Oh, no.
Anyway, I stubbed my toe and fell forward, and I caught myself on the palms of my hands.
Oh, jeez.
And I just tore the devil out of the palms of my hands on the coral.
Rats.
And that's a problem.
Yeah,
because
really.
Because in addition to being painful... It's instant infection with coral. So I go back and Robin the doctor, he bandaged me up and smeared me up with antibiotic lotion and also gave me antibiotic pills. We were able to keep the infection from developing. But again, it was a lesson that if, for example, Earhart had had a similar experience with no antibiotics,
right,
you'd be in real trouble.
Yeah,
in very short order. So, so the expedition leader manages to fix himself good on the second day out. I went around looking like a boxer with my hands all bandaged up. It took probably a week for that to heal enough, so it wasn't a problem. Mm. Oh, I wasn't the only one to hurt myself. One of our new sponsor team, $50,000 sponsor team members,
right,
learned the hard way that it's probably a bad idea to sharpen your machete after you've had a few drinks. And he put a nice slice in his hand.
Oh, gosh.
So we get Robin out to sew him up. Well, it turns out that Robin had always dreamed of being a surgeon, but couldn't because he has a slight tremor in his hands.
Oh, no.
He can do inspections of x-rays just fine, but sewing somebody... That was fun to watch.
Oh, that's of course, awful. Like, did he not disclose that, or?
Well, what he said was, I couldn't be a surgeon because I have this tremor in my hands, but I can make do with it. And he did make do.
Yeah.
But it was just, here's this guy has hurt himself.
So yeah, he did have some anesthesia with him, like topical anesthesia, right?
God, did he?
He had to have.
Yeah.
If he had suture equipment, he had to have brought
I guess he
something.
Numbed it up in some way.
Yeah. Oh, my.
But the whole thing.
He's getting his emergency room experience on the fly.
I mean, it's your sense of humor out there tends to be a little. everybody.
I hope everyone didn't stand around laughing.
Everybody was
that.
Standing around laughing their heads off, as a matter of fact. And here's Robin shaking and putting stitches in his head.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
It's just the way it is. So,
well, good start.
Yeah, we're off to a great start there, you know. Well, all right. So we got to work clearing and working at the seven site. Somebody brought along a thermometer just to check because we knew it was hotter than hell.
Oh.
It was probably a bad idea.
I was going to say, whose idea was that?
Bad idea. 110, 115 degrees by 10 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
it's
my.
Just, you didn't need to
That's
have
like
that
a furnace.
Information.
No.
But the pneumatic loppers work well.
Good.
We clip, clip, clip and carry them out.
Was it heavy to carry the dive tanks?
Yeah. It was heavy, but it wasn't as bad as carting a generator and cans of gasoline down there.
Oh, right.
And
right.
The noise and everything. And we went through four dive tanks a day.
Ah.
And after a few days, one of the loppers had a structural failure that fell. But we did use the chainsaw some, mm-hmm. not very much, because it was obvious that it's pretty dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yes.
Chainsaws and that environment where it's so easy to trip. And it's not like cutting a log. You're cutting stalks, really hard stalks that are
probably
tightly grown together.
Lots of different angles.
It was not good.
Yeah.
But the clearing went well. The old village survey went well. We got in there. The Fijian crew members on the boat pitched in. They came ashore, and boy, those guys.
Oh, I bet they can get some work done in that environment.
They can get work done. They're big, strong guys.
Wow.
And we got in there just putting coconuts on tarps and hauling them away and putting more coconuts on, hauling them away. And then you work the area with a metal detector. And we're finding mostly heavy junk from the village, pieces of old machinery. We did find something that had us excited for a while, a bronze tube, oh, a couple inches in diameter and maybe 3 inches long. It turned out to be, and it had a part number on it.
Oh. So,
and we looked at these part numbers and, oh, well, aircraft sometimes have
sure
these things in it. Yeah. But the more we looked into it after we got home, the more it became apparent that these were almost certainly from the Coast Guard bulldozer from down at the other end of the island.
Right.
Not anything on the Lockheed
that
Electric.
That makes sense.
After we got the 7 site cleared away and metal detected and eyeball search, of course, with metal detectors and search and visually, you're not going to find non-metallic stuff that's buried.
Right.
And so you don't know. Things like bones, you're not, if they're not sitting on the surface, you're not going to find it with a metal detector.
Yeah.
So we only did excavations because there's just too much area there. If we found something really interesting, then with a metal detector or visually, then we would lay out 1 meter square grid around it and get down there hands and knees with trowels and peel it back and see what else is there. And we found some interesting stuff that way. The hole that we reasoned and became apparent was the hole where the skull had been buried and then exhumed. We were hoping that there would still be teeth in that hole. And so we're digging that hole and shoring up the sides with pieces of wood and so it didn't cave in, and screening everything that came out of the hole looking for teeth. Down in that hole, it was, we don't know how hot it was because we put the thermometer down there, but the thermometer only went to 125 and it pegged. So I don't know how hot it was down there. But it was no fun working in that hole.
How big was it once you
The whole final dimensions of that thing, probably about 6 feet square.
Oh.
Big hole.
Interesting, yeah.
Big hole. On the surface, with the metal detector, we're finding a lot of Coast Guard brass, you know, spent cartridges.
Right.
But we also came across more brown glass. We had found some brown glass in 2001.
Didn't you determine that was target practice?
Well,
or was
we didn't
that the
know.
China? I think that was
we found things like old radio vacuum tubes from the Loran station that obviously had been used for target practice and blown apart. But this brown glass, we didn't know. The Coast Guard did have beer just from the fragments of brown, and this looked like glass from maybe a beer bottle, amber colored glass. Right. But just with a few fragments, you couldn't tell what the shape of the bottle was.
Right.
And the Coast Guard beer bottles had a very distinct shape. But we couldn't tell. But we collected it. We set up a unit around the, you know, a meter square unit and dug down. And ultimately discovered that there was also some green glass in there. And we collected the green glass, and there was ash and charcoal. There had been a fire.
Really?
These pieces were in a fire. And nearby, there was a piece of twisted wire that we found with a metal detector. And this wire had been twisted in a way that looks like you could hold a bottle upright in a fire. So maybe somebody is boiling water to purify it.
Yeah,
it's
interesting.
Just a thought. So, but we collected all that. So we were working along, and it's July 24th, and it's Amelia's 110th birthday. Well, okay, there we are at Nicomororo on Amelia's 110th birthday, and the crew of Naya were really on top of this. They had baked a cake. with her name, of course, inscribed on it.
Really?
Somehow they had gotten their hands on a figurine with a leather flying jacket and helmet.
You're kidding. That's funny.
And a little map, and that was on the cake.
Oh.
And so we had this little ceremony, and we had a birthday party for Amelia, and they bring out this cake. And
so this is on the boat. Yeah. You're on the boat. Okay.
Yeah. And there's candles. They didn't put 110 candles on it, but they put a bunch of...
Yeah.
No, as a matter of fact, there's just one candle.
Okay.
There's just one candle on the cake. Mm. And then we said, wait a minute, who's going to blow out the candle? I opened one of the salon windows. So we're moored just offshore.
Yeah.
And I opened one of the salon windows, and I holler, "Happy birthday, Amelia!" And just then, a puff of wind came through and blew the candle out. And everybody just kind of looked at each other, "Oh, my God." Okay, all right. Moving on. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, really.
I think Mark has that on video, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun.
Well, our kite aerial photography was somewhat delayed because the wind was blowing pretty hard the next days. And you need wind to fly the kite, but you can't have too much wind.
It'll just dive
into the ground. Mm-hmm. So that had to be put off for a while. But we had another investigation we wanted to do. On a 1938 aerial photo, it was taken by the New Zealanders who were there to do a survey of the island. There was a feature visible in the photo they took that showed the seven site, and that you could very clearly see the seven of the coral, the natural feature in the shape of a seven. But maybe a quarter of a mile north of that, there was this white area in the photo that looked like an arrowhead. Huh. And it was pointing to something. And in the photos of the island looked anything like that.
Is the sand white? Is the sand white? The sand is white,
but you don't usually see beach sand inland like this.
Okay.
This was in from the shoreline vegetation. It wasn't out on the beach.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, we thought it was interesting. And there was a lot of speculation. Well, is this something Earhart and Noonan created to attract attention?
Yeah.
It's 1938. They disappeared in 1937. We don't know how long they lasted on the island. It's nearby where they seem to have had their campsite. And then we had our forensic imaging specialist, Jeff Glickman, look at that thing in the old photograph. And he said, there might be some man-made material there. I can't be sure, but it might be. Well, let's go see if we can find that spot, see if it still exists, see what's there.
Yeah.
Well, that's easy to say and a lot harder to do. And so we set off through solid scavola to chop our way in to find this place. And after a hard day's work, bottom line was, yeah, there's nothing there but solid scavola. There's no man-made material we can find. It's a dead end. Yeah, it needed to be checked out, but nothing. Hmm. And unfortunately, it's kind of typical for Nick and Moraro. Yeah, okay, that didn't work.
One more thing
didn't work. Yeah. Back at the taphonomy experiment.
Oh, yes.
With the pig carcass. That was going well. The crabs were having a big time. We were getting good time-lapse photos. We knew there were coconut crabs visiting the site. We'd review some of the photos. Mm-hmm. By this time, coconut crabs had been declared an endangered species. And we were not permitted to catch coconut crabs and eat them, as we did on the first couple expeditions.
Right.
Because coconut crabs will spoil you for any kind of shellfish. I mean, they're just...
Really?
Oh, my God, they're good. But, okay, so they're endangered, so we don't do that. And we put out the word. Okay, no, got to leave the coconut crabs alone. Oh, okay, all right. And Fijian crew loves coconut crab. And we told them, I said, no, Oh, coconut crab. Okay, we understand. And I'm having a conversation with, yeah, it was Mo. Mo asked me, he says, so how are things going on the island? I said, they're doing good. And what about, how is it going up there by the bait? The bait? Oh, I mean, the Mo? You guys have been going ashore in the evening. I think I know what you've been doing. We need to knock that up. Oh, Rick, we never eat the coconut crabs. We wouldn't do something like that. I said, Mo, I was born at night, but I wasn't born last night. Now, come on, give me a break here. Just hold it down to a minimum if you can. All right. Okay, by July 28th, the sea had gotten very rough. I mean, and when that happens, we can still go ashore, but it's a lot tougher.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Especially getting people into and out of the skiffs, the rigid-hulled inflatables that we use to go ashore.
Yeah. You know,
they've got aluminum bottoms, inflated sides like a Zodiac. There's a dive deck where you come up along the stern of Naya and you get in and you get out that way. But when the sea is really rough...
Yeah, how did you do that?
You've got... Well, you very carefully is the answer. You pay attention and you don't hurry and you time it. So when the wave brings the skiff up, you step out onto the dive platform right now.
How many people do you take at one time on that skiff?
Oh, we could get up to a dozen people in a skiff.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. But, of course, there's also stuff to pass. You know, we have boxes of stuff, lunch coolers and everything.
Mm.
And so it was really exciting getting people into and out of the skiff. A big part of that is to have big, strong guys from the crew standing there with their hands out to grab your hand and pull you in and help you in.
Wow.
And so we were able to do that without anybody getting hurt. Because
That was just lucky.
If you lose your footing and you fall down between the skiff and the hull,
that's so dangerous.
It's curtains.
Mm. What was the weather like while the seas were really rough? Did you
weather's pretty good.
A breakdown? Yeah. I mean, you had some wind?
There was wind, but basically clear skies. Occasional squalls would come through, but generally pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's just the sea's rough. And of course, when the sea's rough, not only are the transfers from the ship difficult, but the channel gets hairy.
Oh, gosh.
You know, we got this blasted channel with waves running up through the channel, and you've really got to pay attention. But we were able to do that.
And somebody from the boat is running the skiff?
Oh, yeah.
A crew member or so.
Well, somebody from the boat runs the skiff.
Mm.
I had one incident where we had come in through the channel, and we were unloading people, and you had to just either go over one side into like waist-deep water or step out on the other side, if you timed it right, onto the reef flat. But it's going up and down.
This is getting onto the land.
On the land,
yeah.
Getting out of the skiff. And one of the team members went into on the water side and slipped, and she started to fall. So I jumped in to help her, and in doing that, I scraped my leg on the coral again. And it wasn't deep. It wasn't terribly serious. But it was bleeding.
Mm.
And it'll stop. You know, it wasn't a big deal.
Are there sharks in these darn waters?
Well, we got over to the lagoon side and started loading up into the boat on the lagoon to go down to the seventh site, and I was helping people into the skiff, and I was the last one to get up into the skiff through a step on the back, and meanwhile I'm standing there in the water with my leg bleeding, and just as I stepped up into the skiff, this big dark shape went zoom by. Okay. I didn't know he was there.
So what did you end up finding when you did the survey of the seven sites?
We were finding some interesting stuff. We found part of a small pocket knife.
Hmm.
He said, seemed like it looked like it must be part of a pocket knife.
Part of the
but
handle?
It was distinct enough so that we can probably figure out exactly what kind of pocket knife this is.
Ah.
We also found another interesting piece of flat glass, like plate glass from a window, except it was really thin, and it was very much like the piece we found back in 2001.
Oh, I remember you talking about that.
And we thought, well, okay, these seem to be part of the same thing. We didn't know what the thing was at that time. We speculated that this could be part of like a compact mirror.
What did it have? Was it mirrored on one side, or had that worn off?
The silvering was gone.
Yeah. Hmm.
But silvering does wear off.
Yeah, especially in a sandy environment.
Yeah. But that was just speculation. Well, this might be what this is. As it turned out, the two pieces fit together just like a jigsaw puzzle and made it very clear that, yeah, this is part of a mirror from a compact. And we also found little bits of orange-colored, little wafers of orange-colored stuff that turned out to test out chemically as early 20th century makeup.
Oh, interesting.
So it's starting to look like we had a woman's compact. We developed that further. We were able to identify exactly what kind of compact it was. It was an American compact, a Zell Fifth Avenue, New York, 1930s.
Boy, something you'd want to have in a around the world.
Well, Amelia was known to always be ready for the cameras.
She'd have to be. That makes sense.
Yeah. But, of course, at that time, all we knew was, well, we got another little piece of glass like the one we found last time.
Wow.
Interesting. The SRX total station was working really well to shoot in the hits and map the site. After I spent some more time studying the manual, and I made several satellite phone calls to the distributor who had been teaching me how to use it. But we climbed that learning curve, and it was working well. So we wanted to get kite aerial photography of the seventh site, and the wind had backed off enough so we could do that, but we ran into another problem. The birds loved that thing.
Oh, no.
The boobies looked at it and said, what the is this thing? This is interesting. And they're flying into it, running into the string.
Oh, jeez.
But after a while, they, I guess they got used to it, decided it wasn't all that interesting and left it alone. And we got some really good aerial photography of the seventh site.
And that's great. That's a bonus.
The sea did not calm down.
Oh.
It got rougher. Naya was tied off to the Norwich City, which you can do as long as the wind sets from the east, and you can set the sail, and so the boat is
like there's a tension.
Is like moored off to the shipwreck, but you got to watch the wind, because if it backs off, the surf will pull you in on the reef.
Wow!
But even so. There was a lot of, the boat was doing a lot of rolling. It was hard to sleep. Mm. And the transfers from the skiffs were, again, dangerous. The landing channel was hairy.
Wow.
So that wasn't helping, but we were still getting the work done.
How many times a day did you make those trips back and forth?
Oh, no, only once.
You went in the morning and came back at night?
Yeah, first boat over the side around 7:30 in the morning, and you get back aboard before dark.
Wow.
Which is 5:30, 6 o'clock.
Right.
You come back. Huh. By which time you're ready to come back to
Maya. Oh, my, I bet.
On the other hand, there's nothing like coming back aboard to a cold beer and if the boys, the crew, have been out fishing and got a tuna, they slice up the best sashimi, freshest, big slabs laid out with wasabi and a cold beer after a hard day on the island. I still dream of that. I mean, it almost made it all worthwhile.
Seriously. So. And then they had dinner after that.
The drill is you come in, you have your beer and sashimi, and you get a shower.
Yes, I bet that.
And you write up your field notes. You got to write up your field notes, and you turn in the photographs that you've taken. You have a card in your camera, and you turn that in to the person in charge of taking care of that, and your photographs are logged in, and then you can have dinner. And then after dinner, we have a team meeting. We talk about what we did today and what we're going to do tomorrow. But anybody who has any entertainment for the group can do it at that time. The favorite activity was parodies of songs. Yeah, how do I describe this? Several of us would write songs in the off hours with spoof lyrics to tunes everybody knew about things about the island. And we ended up with a whole book of them. We call them Tiger Tunes for Typhoons.
That sounds fun.
It was fun. And maybe one of these times
think maybe you could sing one for us.
I don't have one for right now. This episode is going to be long enough as it is, but maybe...
Yeah, but I won't forget that.
Okay. No, I'll... At the taphonomy experiment, the predictable had happened. The crabs had gone off with the bones. But our attempts to track them weren't having much luck.
Why? What was happening?
Well, we don't know where they went. Yeah, we'd look around with metal detectors and.
Well, how long were these threads that you attached to them?
Well, a couple yards. Yeah, they weren't short.
So they travel for food.
Well, we were wondering where they went,
or if they go way down in the ground.
We don't know, but we never did find the
really
darn things. No, we expanded our search further than anybody thought, but.
They probably decorated with all those strings. They probably down their burrows.
Maybe they're doing interior decoration with
some curtains.
I don't know.
The pictures must have been fascinating, though.
Oh, the pictures will still give you nightmares.
I mean, really?
Oh God!
How many crabs at one time?
Well,
it
wasn't so much the coconut crabs, really. It was the little strawberry hermits, the little strawberry-colored guys in. Borrowed shells about the size of a baseball.
Uh-huh.
Just hundreds and hundreds of them swarming over the carcass at night.
Oh.
And little tiny hermit crabs.
Were
the size of your thumbnail.
Strong enough to... Who carried the bones?
The only crab we saw actually moving a bone was one of the land crabs. The guys with... they walk sideways and they have claws that they hold up on either side of them, and they're kind of everybody thinks of as
like a blue crab.
Yeah,
sort of walk.
Very much like a blue crab.
Hmm.
And we have video of one dragging off a pig foot.
Oh.
The whole foot.
But did the bones disappear?
No, we knew where he left that.
No, but did the other bones disappear?
Yeah.
But you never got photos
of
them
not
leaving?
All of them were carried off, but there were a number that disappeared that we never found.
Wow.
And,
interesting.
And there were some that the crabs just left alone. They were just laying there.
Hmm.
So they went off with some. The takeaway from this seemed to be that it's all about moisture. When the bones still had some meat on them and had ligaments and things that had moisture in them, the crabs were all over that. They loved that.
Huh.
But once that was gone, once you had dry bones, crabs lost interest. There's nothing here. Yeah.
Huh.
Now, whether they would later come back and chew on them for the calcium, we don't know. We weren't there long enough to know that. But yeah, they did seem to lose interest in bones after a while. The crabs and rats at the Seven site we had noticed were much bolder and more aggressive than the crabs up around the village where the taphonomy experiment was. They would actually be a pest when we'd break to have lunch. Lunch coolers were open and the smell of sandwiches and fruit and other food got out. The crabs, hundreds of them, would come out of the bushes, down out of the trees, strawberry hermit crabs. And they would climb up your leg to get at the food in your hand. If you laid down to take a rest, then, oh, somebody has died. You know, and here they come, a whole bunch of them.
Do they bite?
Oh, yeah. They'll bite if you let them. I mean, if you're...
Are they aggressive at all? Like if you tried to disperse them, do they try to fight or
no?
So, but they would,
not like that.
They would try to bite if you looked.
Yeah, if you don't stop them, right. they come up and they look at you and they'll take up their pincher and they'll take a chunk out of your hand. But you don't let them do that.
No.
But that's what makes staying overnight at the Seven site kind of problematic, because you don't want to. But it also makes you think about a castaway who becomes unable to move but isn't dead yet. Not a pretty picture to imagine. The rats also are very brave. They're the little brown Polynesian rats. They're not like the big ugly Norway rats we have. They're like big mice, and they will come and sit beside you on the log and take a piece of bread from your sandwich. But if you also toss out a piece of bread and a strawberry hermit crab grabs it, which they will, a rat is likely to mug them to get the piece of bread away from them. They're fun to watch.
Yeah. Really?
It's a strange place. It really is. You just sit there with nature all around you watching these things. Whoa. It's kind of different here. We were doing some metal detecting in the lagoon. Not finding much. I was wading around kind of up to my waist in the lagoon with a metal detector.
And they're made to use underwater, the metal detectors.
Oh, yeah. They work underwater. Yeah. And but there was this one black-tipped shark that just followed me around.
Oh.
He wasn't... He was like 4 or 5 feet.
Uh-huh.
You know, but he was always back there. He's just... I named him Nicodemus after the shark in... Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, that used to follow the ship, waiting for people to fall overboard. Yeah, Nicodemus followed me around every day. And if I didn't keep my eye on him, he would get closer.
You know? Really?
And he's like a dog, you know.
Just to make sure you notice. And
a couple times I had to bump him in the nose with the metal detector just to... It's just strange. One of the things that was found at the Seven site, we're up to August 1st now, found a zipper pull.
Really?
Yeah.
Where?
At the Seven site.
At the Seven site?
Yeah. And it was a metal detector hit. And it was a brass zipper, just the slider.
So it had the markings on it then?
It said Talon on it.
Oh, right.
And, you know, I could report this via satellite phone and quickly get, okay, Talon, American company. We can find out more about this. You know?
Right.
Is it a style that was issued to the Coast Guard? Or can we date
it?
I mean, but... Yeah, this is interesting. We had also found both ends of a snap, just a little snap like you'd have on clothing.
Like a snap on a pocket?
Like a snap on a pocket. Little. Mm. And there are no markings on it, but it's another apparent piece of clothing. And we had found a couple of buttons. So, So it's starting to look like, how do all these items from clothing that has since rotted away get here?
Yeah.
I mean, the Coast Guard guys are not likely to leave their clothes laying around.
No.
So we need to find out more about this stuff. Hmm. So we're happy about these finds. And we find more places where there had been little campfires, burned pieces of fish bone and turtle bone and bird bones. You know, it's very apparent that this was not just somebody's one-time picnic. You know, somebody was living here for a while and catching and eating local stuff and maybe boiling water on a fire with bottles they got from someplace. So it was looking pretty interesting. As we mentioned, we had wanted to get good aerial photography of the reef surface with kite aerial photography. Mm-hmm. And we were able to do that.
Oh, good. The wind calmed down and the birds wind calmed down. Let you.
We got the kite up over the reef flat at low tide and got a whole bunch of really good pictures. Great detail from an altitude of, it was probably 50 feet.
Oh, something like that.
I still use those photographs. They're better than anything we've gotten later from a drone.
Oh, how about
They're fantastic. And, of course, you can stitch them together and you can have a panorama of that whole area.
Right.
Including the ship wreckage, so you can tie it all together. Then we set out to do our reef survey that we talked about.
Right, the one that was going to be around
We had to shoot around the corner and... So we knew what we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it. So we were able to shoot up to the waypoint on the reef, but then shooting up to the area where the plane landed, we couldn't shoot further than the shipwreck because the shipwreck's in the way.
Oh, huh.
So we established we wanted to establish a datum point at the shipwreck.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do that. And it's like many hundreds of yards. I mean, it's a long way off.
And were you going to pick a point on the ship that you could see from both sides?
Well,
I mean, if it was in the way.
We picked an oil tank.
Okay.
That was a prominent
piece
of wreckage.
Yeah.
It was high. The problem was we needed a specific point to shoot to. Not the whole thing. And we tried using the infrared target because that's what the SRX was designed to do. It's going to shoot to this infrared target on the graduated pole and you'll get your specific point. Trouble was, in the background, there was a lot of sun dazzle off the sea. And it totally defeated the infrared.
Oh, really?
It couldn't make
up. Could you wait till another time of day to do it?
We were running out of time. Oh. We were going to have to leave tomorrow.
Oh, no.
This was the last thing we were going to do. So we got to do this. How do I do this? All right. We're going to do it the old-fashioned way. So I put the crosshairs on the SRX. This is like shooting a rifle.
Right.
I had... one of our team members, it was John Klaus, put his white hat on the end of the graduated pole and hold it up against the dark background of that oil tank.
Oh.
So I had a white spot to shoot for.
Yeah.
And I put the crosshairs on that and I hit it. Best shot I ever made. But we got our datum point, and from there we were able to move the SRX up to the beach.
Mm.
Beyond the shipwreck
and shoot back
and tie things in and get a whole bunch of points up there that we were later able to construct a map of the reef flat with accurate elevations.
Wow.
So we got that done.
Wow.
But it wasn't easy.
Well, did you complete everything you wanted to?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I mean, that was quite an ambitious schedule.
We didn't find a smoking gun, you know.
Right.
But you never do.
No, and sometimes you don't know till you get home what you have.
And this was certainly true. But by the time we left Niku on August 2nd and got down to Samoa, I was hand carrying the zipper pull and slider for the zipper. The snap.
Yeah.
And the piece of flat glass that might be part of a mirror. And the piece of a pocket knife. And the brown and green bottle glass.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. I mean, we had this treasure trove of little bits and pieces of stuff. And we just felt great about that. We were tired. But I remember we got back to Fiji. Of course, we went to Samoa, and then we caught a regional airline flight back to Fiji. And Mark did kind of a post-expedition interview with me at the hotel. And I remember sitting there holding that zipper slide in the palm of my hand and saying, you know, Nikumaro may be finally giving up its secrets. You know,
wow.
That's what it felt like.
Wow.
So.
We
had the outline of a story that appeared in these burn features, fish, bird, turtle remains, clothing remains. A castaway lived here, ate here, died here, and did this person die wearing the clothing, which is now disintegrated completely, aside from the metal pieces that I'm now holding in my hand?
Right.
We had this wealth of artifacts to research and photos and data to analyze. And next time we'll talk about how all that turned out.
Oh, gosh. Well, how exciting. I'm anxious to hear. Eager to hear.
I'm eager to tell you.
Okay. We'll talk to you next time.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Earhart Expeditions is a serial history of Tiger's 12 expeditions to the South Pacific. We release a new episode each Tuesday. You can receive special bonus episodes and get access to Tiger's extensive video library by becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to Patreon, that's Patreon, and search on Tiger, Tiger. You can also be a part of the adventure and participate in research. Go to tiger.org and click on Join Tiger. See you next Tuesday.